How Do We Know? Part 1. The fourth talk in the series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth was presented by Charlie Dewberry on November 5, 1991, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at the question of how we know and what we know. And that may seem like kind of a strange question to ask. Why would we be interested in this question? And that's certainly one of the things I want to talk about. But before we do that, I'd like to just give you an overview of what's at stake in this question. And then I want to talk a little bit about why I think it's something we ought to spend a little time looking at. So the first probably 20 minutes or so, that's what I'm going to be aiming at doing. Basically, what we're looking at is what they call in philosophy epistemology. And that really is the question of how we know what we know. And in philosophy, it's the study of the nature and grounds for knowledge. And I'm going to explain more as we go what the nature and grounds really are, what that means. But those kind of questions are concerned with these kinds of questions. And I think a lot of them occur in everyday kinds of situations. But what I've done here is I've put them more or less in philosophical categories. And I just did this for you to help give you a framework to kind of pigeonhole some of these kind of topics that come up and how they relate to philosophy. So one of the things we're concerned with here is how can we know? I mean, I'm sure that all of us from time to time have been hit with the person who will say something or we believe something's true, and the person just says, well, how do you know that? Yeah, what makes you think that's true? What kind of proof have you got for that? What makes you think there's a real world out here in space with real trees and cars and people in it? What makes you think that? What proof have you got that that's true? Well, if you really try to answer that kind of person, you'll find out that it's trickier than it seems. And we'll see as we go through that philosophers through the ages have denied a lot of stuff that many of us take for granted. But when we really look at why they wanted to deny them, we can see that their questions are not as easily answered as we might think. The first kind of question we'll deal with is this, what's called skepticism. The person who will really question all our beliefs and say, why do you believe that? What proof do you have? And the proof is the grounds. That's what we mean by grounds for knowledge. The second kind of question that people in philosophy have looked at over time is the question of how do we know? And lots of different schemes have been proposed for this. One of them is called rationalism. And rationalism basically starts with something that's just certain. We know it's true. That if we start with something, we know it's true, and we then deductively, we step by step, work our way through a proof, then we're always going to come up with what's true. So a rationalist believes that deduction, this kind of deductive logic, is what really works, and that gives us truth. And rationalists would claim that's the only method we have to get at truth. So an example might be, take something like geometry. That's kind of a model they like to point at. You start out with axioms. You start out with things as givens. And if the givens are true, then deductively these things are going to happen. These things would be logical consequences of those. And so that's the kind of scheme that a rationalist will try to put together. The next one is empiricism. I think all of us are quite familiar with empirical science. It's a term we use quite a lot. The general notion is here that any claim to know something has to be based on experience. That if you don't have scientific data to support your view, then you have no right to claim that view is true. You have no ground for believing that view is true. So an empiricist would claim that how do we know something? Well, we know it by experience. And experience is the only way we really know anything, would be the claim of an empiricist. The next claim would be an authoritarian. And this person would say, well, somebody said so. An example of this, in certain contexts, it could be a Christian claiming Jesus or the apostles said so. That would be considered at least an authoritarian kind of claim. Or anyone. You might say, so-and-so said so. So that your claim of how you get your knowledge, how do we know, is because wiser people than me said so. So that would be the kind of claim to know that an authoritarian would make. Yeah, that would loosely fit in here as well. And as I say, with all of this, I'm kind of trying to take examples that we're familiar with and kind of with a broad brush, put them into these philosophical categories that just to help you somehow frame these kind of things in some kind of view, just to help you with where they fit. But yes, a claim that the Bible would be the authority, that could fit in with this authoritarian kind of claim. Yes, that piece of it would fit here. But as we'll see soon, that's not the only piece of this as well that we need to deal with as Christians. But yes. The last one is pragmatism. Pragmatism, it's basically the notion that all knowledge really is practical, and that there really isn't knowledge as we have always wanted to claim there's knowledge. What the pragmatist wants to say with regards to how do we know, what the pragmatist claims is we have an individual in its environment, and the environment changes over time, and the individual changes over time, and what knowledge is just an interaction between these two things. So all that we know is an interaction between ourselves and an environment. And those things we know in interacting with our environment, that's knowledge. And knowledge for the pragmatist changes. It's just practical. It's what's useful to us to live our lives. So what was useful to people 2,000 years ago, it's probably not all that relevant to us today for the most part. I mean, we live in a very different world that looks different to us. We have altogether different kinds of problems. The knowledge we're concerned with is really different from the knowledge they're concerned with. And so how we know is an individual interacting with their environment. So that would be a pragmatic view. Next question is, how do we perceive the world? There's three different answers that have been given to this. A realist basically says that, well, we see a real world that's out here that's independent of us. I mean, the tree that's in the backyard, that really exists out there. It's a real tree, material object. And it exists out there even if I don't see it right now. But it's out there. There's a real physical world. The next category says that what we really know are ideas in our mind. That's what we're really aware of. So for this group, they would say things like, when we look at a cherry, what we're aware of is red color, a shape, and a certain taste. And so when we think of those kinds of things, we think of cherry. In fact, we attach the word cherry to those sensations in our mind that happen. So what we're aware of is sensations in our mind. But then we have the question of how the sensations relate to our world. And there's several different answers that were given, but the most straightforward one is just, well, that there's a relationship between what we see and we're aware of in our mind. It relates to an external world out here. So according to this group, what we perceive in the world, or how we perceive in the world, is we perceive sensations or objects or ideas in our mind. That's what we see. The realist would claim we see real things in space. So that would be the difference between a realist. A realist says we see trees, the physical object tree. We see those. We see those directly. The representative perceptionist wants to say Well, we don't really see trees directly, but we have these sensations that there's a whole mechanism that got these thoughts into our mind, and we have our thoughts in our mind. That's what we're aware of. And then we infer the existence of a world. And the last one is the idealists. And to an idealist, it sounds very strange, but idealism is basically a view that says external objects do not exist unless they're perceived. So I'll give you an example of one view of this. It was put forth by a philosopher named Berkeley. And what Berkeley said is that, well, if there's that tree in the backyard, if nobody sees it right now, it doesn't exist. It only exists when it's seen, when it's perceived. Because if the only thing that's real are sensations in our mind, if that's the only thing that's real that we know of, then how in the world could we say there's real trees out there? What kind of proof would we have for that? You may think Berkeley's view is really weird and really strange, but then if I tell you that he's a Christian, and his view was put forward to essentially refute materialism, then maybe it's worth another look. Because in the end, Berkeley's view isn't refutable, as simple as you'd think. And the reason is, what Berkeley would say is, well, yeah, maybe none of us are looking at the tree out there and perceiving it in the backyard, but God is. And so, see, it's God's mind that's ultimately real. And so what's really real is what's in God's mind. And so, see, when we perceive stuff and it's in our mind, that's what's real. That's an idealist. That's an idealist. So it's counter-commonsensical. But what Berkeley wants to say is there is no physical world in three-dimensional space. That's a figment of our imagination. All there is sensations. All we have are ideas in our mind. So anyway, that's another view of how to perceive the external world. And then this question of how beliefs are justified. One view is that's called foundationalism. And basically what it says is all our beliefs fit into a kind of pyramid kind of structure. And there's a lower tier here, and these are basic or foundational kinds of beliefs. And a foundationalist wants to say that just because these beliefs, the foundation, they don't need to have a proof or a warrant or a justification for being. We don't have to have evidence. We don't have to give evidence for these. These just play this role. Now, all our beliefs that are above this, they all have to be justified, or we have to have a proof for them. And the proof for them will all be the lower tier. So this is one system of how beliefs are justified. The other system actually arose because people didn't think this was possible. And it basically says that all our beliefs are just in a network. So this is A, this is B, C, D, but then B relates to E, E relates to A, E relates to C, E relates to D, that there's just this big web. It doesn't ground anywhere, but there's just a big web of beliefs. And so when we're talking about giving justification or evidence for beliefs, this view says, well, all we can do is say this belief is related to this belief. It's justified because it's coherent with. It's coherent. This view E is coherent with B, A, C, D. A is coherent with E, B, C, D. So it's just this big mesh of coherent beliefs, okay, that there really are no beliefs that ground to anything, for instance, like in reality. So what people want to hold who hold this kind of a justification belief is basically that it's possible to have two different coherent views that say reality is different, and yet there's no way that you could get evidence to differentiate the two, because all you have is coherence. See, all you can point to with beliefs is that they're coherent. So within each system, these are coherent. But the problem is, if you want to ask whether this system is a better representation of reality than this one, you can't ask that question, because within these views, they will tell you what ground, what counts as evidence. So, for instance, this view would say A, B, C count as evidence. Those are fundamentally the important evidence. This side over here would say D, E, F. Well, how could you argue back and forth? I mean, you have no common ground. There's nothing to argue about. So you can have two totally different views of the world as far as how you're going to ground beliefs. And you never could show one is any better than the other, ever. Okay? Now, I know that's a real smorgasbord, and it probably doesn't make much sense at this point.
Does that coherence mean that they kind of stick together as opposed to making sense?
Well, it's just...
because if B relates to E, and E relates to C and D, but E is utterly...
Well, no, I actually meant like different beliefs here. I didn't mean that these were the same. I mean, they would all relate to each other. What's that?
Well, it would seem that even then within a person, you could have two utterly different belief systems.
Within one person?
Yeah.
Well, if you were schizophrenic enough, sure. But see, the problem with that is that it isn't coherent. And so coherence is the only thing that counts.
But coherence, I mean, within... so then you're defining exactly where it's coherent. Which is
the whole
person.
Yeah. But see, what the coherence is, well, we're only talking about right now the justification for saying, in other words, what the justification for a belief is. Okay. Well, what I said was is that this view could say all knowledge comes by the senses. That might be a statement that this view makes. And all their beliefs inside of this would be coherent with that. Well, this one might say all knowledge comes from reason, not experience. Okay? So, for instance, you could have a whole set of beliefs here. Like, think of a mathematician over here or somebody that does geometry. Okay? It's a coherent view. Well, what the mathematician wants to say, well, what the empiricist wants to say against the rationalist would be, well, the empiricist would say, yeah, but you got no connection to reality. I mean, you got nothing in your system that tells you what relates to reality. And the mathematician goes, so? I don't care. That's not something I'm concerned with in my system. That's not a justification for a belief. Where the empiricist wants to say, if you don't have data from your senses, then you have no way to claim it's true. So, see, the point is they're two coherent systems, but they keep talking past each other because they have no common ground.
I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I'm wondering about, okay, A relates to B, B relates to all these things. They all relate to one another.
Mm-hmm.
If you come across a time when E doesn't relate to D all of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
But it relates to A and mm-hmm. that relates to B, which eventually relates to D.
Mm-hmm.
If it ends up not relating to D,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that, in effect, it can't actually relate to the other ones if you go through the web backwards?
Well, actually...
say that it's not coherent, and if it's not coherent, does that mean it doesn't exist?
Okay. There's two different versions, kind of a strong view of it and a weak view. And I'll give you the weak view, because that's the one that's more plausible. Is, well, look, take your everyday experience. When you look at the world, you basically use all the information that you know is true, and you're walking around, and all of a sudden you see something that doesn't fit, that's not coherent. Well, what do you do with that? Well, you start looking at your whole network of beliefs and you figure out, how can I explain this? How can I make it coherent with my other views? It might mean that I got to erase D, that, you know, D doesn't fit. So I've got to take D out and put G in here. So I may have to take D out. So,
but then in taking D out, that's going to take A out because it was connected to A.
Well, but not, see, they don't have to be connected in the same way. See, the fact that A is coherent with, let me see if I can give you an example. Okay, let's say we think that we've got, A is, we notice that there's a lot of skyscrapers in cities. And B is that there's a lot of cancer in cities. So we also have a view E that skyscrapers cause cancer. Okay? Well, that belief's true. This belief's true. But the problem is this one's not. Well, we can find that here's a place where we got skyscrapers, but no, we don't have cancer, right? So anyway, so we just erase that one and just make the network here. But see, that's how we learn things in a coherent system. That's how we build it. It will always be coherent. That's the only category.
So you can rationalize anything through code.
Right, absolutely. That's the point.
There's almost an irony in that it's not justified with regard to the system. It's justified outside of the system.
No, it's justified only within the system. Well, yeah. Okay, that's in the weaker version. That's right. That we do have the ability at points to see that a piece isn't coherent, and we can make it coherent. Now, the strong version is that this view determines what we see. And so if that determines what we can see, then, yeah, we aren't going to change our views very often. We're just going to see everything is coherent, okay? And so if, in fact, we have a real change in our view of something, it's got to come from totally outside the system and be an external kind of factor. It can't be an internally induced factor. Okay, now, I've said a lot of stuff here, and like I say, I just wanted to give you a smorgasbord of what's out here, because by the time we get to the end of 3 weeks, just working through a piece at a time, thinking about our ordinary experience, you're going to have answers and understand all those categories. That's the objective. So I don't intend that you understand those categories or exactly how they relate. But in the end, if this is successful, I think you'll be able to say, oh yeah, I know what the skeptic's argument is, and here's how I respond to that. Or here's what a rationalist thinks, and I think this is what's wrong with that. Or an empiricist. So by the end, I think that this will make sense to you. Or at least that's the objective. So I expect that at this point, at least some of the points are baffling. So that's what I expect. And if it is, great. If it's not, let's go home. Because you got it all. So anyway, this may seem like kind of a strange way to do this. But I think by having this framework of seeing the questions we're going to answer as we go along, it'll be helpful as we build one piece at a time, because we'll see how these pieces are going to fit in the picture at the end. Okay, now why is this relevant to us? Basically, because what I want to argue is that we really have an idea of how we know stuff. We have a real good idea how we know stuff. I mean, we probably haven't thought about it real carefully. But if somebody basically walks in and says, yeah, I saw a UFO down here at 19th and University. I mean, it just cruised right in. You might ask, well, what makes you think there was a UFO? Well, I saw it. And I mean, things like simple little experiences like this tell us that we know what we would accept as an answer here. If the person just said, well, you know, I just thought there was one, I didn't see it or nothing, but I mean, I know it was there. I don't have any real evidence or anything, but I mean, I know it was there. Well, see, we all intuitively kind of know what we're going to accept for evidence and what we're not. What I want us to do in the next few weeks is just consciously look at that kind of process, because what I'm claiming is we've already tacitly and subconsciously done this our whole life. All we're going to do is we're going to back up and take a look at it. Because one, we've learned it because that's right and true and good. But the other reason is we've learned it because that's what our culture told us is the way we ought to look at it. So anyway, some of those things we may want to take a look at as we work our way through here. But what I'm arguing is we already have theories. You really already have an answer to all those questions. You just haven't probably thought about it and articulated it. But every one of you have a pretty full-blown theory of how it really works. Like I say, you may not have articulated it, but I think you do. My argument is it's inevitable that you have this. And what I'm going to argue is that we're always seeking for a view of reality that's comprehensive and coherent. So when we walk around in the world and we see stuff that doesn't fit the way we think it ought to be, I think most of the time that bugs us. And we want stuff to fit. If there's a lot of stuff going on that we just can't explain, that we don't have any clue what's going on, I think that bugs us. It's built in that it bugs us. And I think The other part of this is comprehensiveness. We want to be able to explain all of our experience in life. And again, I think that's kind of built in, that we have this desire. The second reason I think it's relevant for us to know this is sometimes we're wrong. And as we live life, every once in a while we hit those times where we go, you know, boy, I always thought that was true. And son of a gun, it's not. And what led me to believe it was true? And can I spare myself other kinds of errors? And so by looking at this process carefully and asking ourselves what beliefs we ought to hold and why, I think it'll help us. It'll help us make better decisions and learn. Yeah, and that relates right to the third point, is that not only has it happened to us once, but we'd really want to keep it from happening again. And the last one is that as we live our lives, we want to talk to people and persuade them that a belief we have is true and one they have is false. Well, one of the things we need to think about is think about how it is we really claim to know that our belief is true. And so in interacting with other people, if they have ideas on how things are justified or on what basis they're justified or different claims to know in different scopes, we will need to be able to interact with them on that question before we can actually even interact with them as far as what our content question is.
Can we even help but want to persuade others on any issue, not just, say, the issue of Christ's death?
Well, I think I would probably argue that we all believe that our views are true, that none of us believe we hold false ones, and the beliefs that we hold that we think are the most true, that, yeah, a natural human response is going to be we want to convince others that we're right. I think that's true.
How do you think love, that we want them to know?
Well, I think
it's going to enhance their life. Or
I think for a lot of stuff it goes deeper than that. That I think I would argue that, and I don't know, maybe just the people I run up against or I interact with are a little different. But, I mean, if I really think A is true and somebody else thinks not A is true, and A is kind of important to me, it's important in my life, we're going to knock heads. It's just going to happen. So I don't think it's just love. I mean, that's certainly one reason why it would. But I think it's pretty deep that we would want to make that kind of claim, that we would be motivated just because we believe something is true and it's important in our life and living it, that, yeah, we want other people to view the world like we do. So I think that goes deeper than just that one.
Do you think that largely a part of like people wanting to persuade other people so much, maybe on minor issues and maybe even major issues, is because someone else disagreeing with them makes them uncomfortable, it affects their insecurities?
Sometimes, yeah. Like I say, that's a complicated issue. And, I mean, I don't want to say in every case that we're just going to knock heads, that's just the way it is. But I think it really is true of us that when we have beliefs, and to the extent that we really think they're true and that they're important beliefs, that I think it's pretty much human that we're going to desire to convince other people that we're right. I think that's true.
There's an irony in the very question, but would that necessarily be the case, that, you know, the irony I'm talking about?
I don't know.
The fact that I'm asking this question means that it's somewhat what I want to persuade. But it seems that there would be other times where it might not be as crucial, like, say A is not A, is if it's someone who, like, in a case where they're going to be evaluating you in terms of your ability to do something later on, it becomes more important because there's something real vital at stake. I think some of you are talking about. But if it's not, like, this is just some Joe who I'm probably not going to interact with very much, or it's not going to rub me the wrong way very often, I might not want to persuade them, except for I persuade them maybe in the way I live my life or something. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be certain cases, certainly, that I would acknowledge that's true. But, I mean, I think if we just think about ourselves as people, that in general, when there's people that really disagree with us in something that's very fundamental to our lives, that we're just because we believe it and just because it's important to how we live our life, that fact alone, I think, is going to be impetus enough for us to want to try to convince them that we're right. But anyway, I don't really want to get totally bogged down on that. But I think I think there's something, let's just say, pretty deep in that we believe our views are true. And I think we do want to interact with other people, and certainly it a lot of times persuade them that we're true, that our view is true. Okay, so where are we going in the next 3 weeks? Well, basically what we're going to do is we're going to start kind of down at ground zero, and we're going to articulate, we're going to kind of flesh out our whole theory of knowledge and our whole theory of epistemology. That's what we're going to do in the next few weeks. So as I say, by the time we get to the end, you should be able to figure out which blanks, which categories you fit in for all the questions when we get to the end of this.
Is there necessarily right or wrong one as far as biblically, or is it just the way that different humans view things? Or I'm to the persuasion that I try to put things in categories of right and wrong.
Okay, well, let's just hold that for a minute if we can. Let's just hold that if we can till we get a little bit farther in, and then we'll ask that question. I mean, it'll come up. There's no question that'll come up. But let's not start there. I hope I've said stuff that doesn't totally make sense, and you can fill in all the blanks, because if so, go home, let's give up on the next couple of weeks. There's no reason to do it. But I think that, at least hopefully, I've created a little confusion, and not just by my explaining it in a bad way. I mean, I hope that this is good confusion. Okay, so, well, what's the nature of the problem? What I'd like to do is just look real quickly in real broad brush at just two answers to what is knowledge and how do you know? Now, these are two pretty old ones. One's Plato and one's Aristotle. And like I say, this is going to be a very broad brush. But I just want to show you two different answers that have been given. First, Plato's. Okay. Knowledge for Plato is what is, meaning it's real, and it's infallible. There's no mistakes. It's certain. So you ask Plato, how would you know? How would you know something? Well, the first thing Plato's going to say, well, you don't know anything by the senses, because haven't your senses ever tricked you? Haven't you ever been wrong? You can't know anything by way of the senses. Knowledge comes by reason. Okay? Now, the next part is when we look at objects, how do we think about objects and their attributes, if you will? For Plato, Plato says there's objects and properties, okay? Now, what Plato wants to say is, properties are really real. Properties are fundamentally more real than objects. So, for example, Plato would say, the Athenian constitution is just. What Plato wants to say is, there's a real idea of justice that's real, that's what is, that never changes, and that we can know by reason with certainty. So things like justice, truth, goodness, those are real things that never change. Now see, the Athenian constitution, I mean, it might be just today, but give them 5 years. They'll probably change it. It won't be just anymore. So the point is, see, for Plato, these objects are less real. Because, see, these change. They aren't knowledge. Because knowledge is, you have to have eternal, it has to be eternal and timeless. It never changes. Well, the Athenian constitution changes. But justice, truth, goodness, those things never change. And we know those by reason, not from our data of our senses. Okay, so that's what Plato wants to say. Now, Aristotle says, whoa, wait a minute. I'll agree on what knowledge is. I won't disagree with that. But I'm real troubled by this. I think knowledge, all knowledge, comes by way of the senses. Aristotle's a biologist. He wants to say to Plato, well, Plato, come on, get real. What do you know about a hippopotamus without seeing one? If you've never seen one, you tell me what a hippopotamus looks like. How can you possibly claim to know anything in the world? Everything we know in the world comes by our sense data. So there's nothing that we don't know by way of our sense data. Okay, now for Aristotle, we have objects and we have attributes. So what Aristotle wants to say is, well, look, the only way you know about a horse is to see a horse. These are what are real. These are real objects. This is what is. The objects are real. This particular horse is real. We know about something called horseness only because we know what horses are. There isn't this whole other world of properties that are real out there in timeless space. The only way we know about horses is the actual horse we see. I mean, tell me anything about a horse that you don't get by the data of your five major senses.
What if you're told it's an animal? You say horse, animal, and then Plato knows it's an animal, and Aristotle knows it's an animal. Can't you, in fact, is it just that Plato's ignoring what he considers like the details, like, okay, well, it's an animal, that's good enough for me?
Not totally, but let's hold it, because we want to come back and answer this. I want to just get the views out tonight so you can think about it. But yeah, we'll come back and deal with that directly, because yeah, that's one of the fundamental things we want to talk about. But I don't want to do that just this second. Okay, so what Aristotle wants to say is horses are animals. And yeah, like I say, I'll talk about what they might mean like in different next time. But what I want to say is, can you see the difference here? Can you see the real distinction in the two views? But now ask yourself this. How is Plato going to deal with things like horses? And how is Aristotle going to deal with something like truth, justice?
So Plato's way of thinking doesn't just include abstract things. It's about all things.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
He does have a hard time with horses then. Okay.
Yeah. Like I say, I don't want to go into real great detail about their two views. But basically, Plato is an idealist because what are fundamentally real are the properties, not the stuff we see in the world, but things in this world of forms, as he called it. Those are what's real. The other is, he would be a rationalist in general because all knowledge comes by reason. Aristotle is a realist and he's an empiricist. And so this is a dichotomy that through human history, philosophers and people have struggled with ever since. Because you get pulled and pushed both ways with different questions and at different points in time. For certain kinds of things, you want to lean this way. For certain kinds of things, you want to lean over here. Well, see, in the end, we want comprehensiveness and we want coherence. So what I'm going to say is in the next 2 weeks, we're going to try to build a view that handles both of these things. Okay, now I'll stop here because that's about as far as I'm going to get right now, tonight. And we'll come back next time and, as I say, begin to build it. But what I wanted right now is just to get the framework out here of all the kinds of things we want to talk about. And then, as I say, I wanted to give you these two broad, general cases of examples of how we deal with this question. And maybe during the week, if you have any time, just start thinking about, how you would answer some of this stuff. Just begin to reflect a little bit on what it is, what kinds of things do you claim to know, and how is it that you think you claim to know them. And anyway, in the next 2 weeks, hopefully I'll sort out some of the muddle I've created. So, anyway, thanks.